two meetings. The president had met Ehrlichman from 10:25 to 11:20 and Haldeman from 11:26 to 12:45. Buzzard had advised Woods that the subpoena applied only to the Ehrlichman meeting. She was not to concern herself about the Haldeman meeting. Haig and the president had told Buzzard a few days later that there was a problem, as Woods was transcribing the first meeting and searching ahead to find when Ehrlichman had left the room and thus where the meeting ended. She had accidentally erased 4 or 5 minutes of the second conversation. Well, Buzzard told Powers, that explained why the technician's meter readings indicated that segments of the tapes were blank. They could expect to find such a place on the tapes just after the subpoena discussion. Double-checking what was called for by the subpoena, he asked if Powers agreed that the Haldeman conversation, now partially obliterated, was not among the items called for. Powers pointed out that a memorandum submitted to the court by Cox in support of his subpoena had a clarifying clause. After listing the Ehrlichman conversation, the memo added, "Then Haldeman went to see the president." Though the subpoena's reference to a single meeting involving all three men might be ambiguous, the supporting memo was clear. It contained an additional distinction. From 10:30 a.m. until 12:45 p.m., Powers was sure both meetings had to be provided. Buzzard unhappily agreed. Why hadn't he read the prosecutor's memo carefully when it arrived in August? He wondered aloud. The erased portion of the tape was under subpoena. With Powers' assistance, he began plowing back and forth through the Ehrlichman meeting on the Sony 800B. First, Buzzard listened alone. Then he rewound the machine and turned one of the earphones toward Powers. The two men listened, their heads pressed together like Siamese twins. They timed each segment with a stopwatch, marking the indices to privileged material. They struggled to hear the words. Voices rose and fell and sometimes faded completely. China cups met saucers in a clamor. Feet crashed into desks. Straining, they listened to the voices through the background noises. What they heard had nothing even remotely to do with Watergate. The conversation would be covered by executive privilege. They listened on beyond the point that Woods had been told was the end of the subpoenaed conversation, waiting for the 4 or 5 minute segment she said she had erased. They heard the buzz and waited for it to end. They waited longer than 5 minutes, longer than 10, longer than 15. At last, it ended. They rewound the tape and listened again, this time using the stopwatch. 4.5 minutes into the buzz, the pitch changed. It sounded like a separate erasure to Buzzard. The total gap was 18 minutes and 15 seconds long. Buzzard hurried to tell Haig, leaving Powers to guard the tapes. Even in the security of the White House, they were afraid of leaving the tapes alone for a few minutes in a locked room. Buzzard poked his head into Haig's office, and the general walked over to the door. "I've got yet another problem," Buzzard said. "Fine. I'll be with you when I finish," said Haig, and he went to resume his discussion of the Middle East with William E. Timmons, head of the Congressional Relations Staff, and General Brent Scowcroft, Haig's successor as deputy to Henry Kissinger. Buzzard, effectively dismissed, went back to the tapes. It was almost 9 p.m. when Haig walked down the hall and into the office, where Buzzard and Powers sat fretfully preparing the index. Buzzard's normally soft voice was now nearly inaudible. "Do you recall the accident that Rose described to the president?" "Of course," Haig recalled. "We have just put a timer on the gap, and instead of 4.5 to 5 minutes, it runs 18+ minutes, Buzzard said. Haig looked surprised. "But that is not all," Buzzard continued. "I have reassessed and rechecked the subpoena, and both Sam and I have concluded that this, in fact, is a subpoenaed conversation." Haig exploded. "Well, damn it, Fred, this is a pretty late date to be telling me something like that." He demanded to see the subpoena. His eyebrows pulled together as he read. "This is pretty goddamn ambiguous, Fred," How can you tell what this means, anyway? It could be interpreted either way, couldn't it?
Yes, said Buzzard. But there is an additional exposition describing the subpoenaed items. He passed him the Cox memorandum.
I must share your judgment, Haig said, finally. How the hell could we have been confused on this, Fred?
Buzzard had no satisfactory answer. He simply hadn't focused on the clarifying memorandum when it came in, he said. It was a small portion of the special prosecutor's brief in the earlier litigation.
Haig was too practical to waste time arguing. What sort of gap was it?
Buzzard didn't know. There were two distinct parts to the buzz.
What could they do now? Haig asked. Perhaps the conversation could be recovered.
Buzzard's 4 years in the Army Air Force as a communications officer and electronics and radar repair specialist made him skeptical. Perhaps, but it was doubtful. Haig was faced with informing the president. The timing was absolutely awful. The president was in the midst of a very, very difficult week. In addition to the Middle East and energy crises, Nixon was conducting a public relations campaign to assert his innocence and re-establish his credibility. Over the next 2 days, he was scheduled to meet with 5 different congressional groups. By the next day, he would have met with all 234 Republican members of Congress. At that very moment, he was seeing some senators. The next morning, he was to address the National Association of Realtors. There would be heavy press and photo coverage. Haig worried about the effect of the news on the old man. The constant public exposure throughout the week would be a strain. This news, coming so soon after the disclosure that 2 of the subpoenaed conversations were not on tape, would be devastating to the president's position. The additional pressure would take its toll. Haig wanted to wait. The next morning, while Haig kept his silence, the president met with 78 Republican congressmen who applauded as Nixon said emotionally, "I'm not going to walk away from my job." Even the president's critics in the room were impressed by his determination to stay and fight. Haig thought the session had gone well, and he still kept quiet. Later in the morning, the president was given a standing ovation by 3,000 members of the National Association of Realtors. Blaming Watergate and other campaign abuses on overzealous associates, Nixon said they had made mistakes that I never approved of, mistakes that I would never have tolerated, but mistakes for which I will have to take the responsibility. Haig waited another 50 minutes while the president sat for pictures with members of the American Legion and met with Cambodia's ambassador and Minister of Foreign Affairs. Then, at 12:36 p.m., he went into the Oval Office to break the news. The president blew up. He was so enraged that such a mistake had been committed that Haig didn't know for a while which mistake Nixon was referring to. Then it was clear. The president was outraged not at the gap, but at Buzzard's error. What the hell were they supposed to do now, he wanted to know. It was incredible that Buzzard could have made such a blunder. Did they have to turn the tape over? How would they explain the gap? What was wrong with his lawyers? Haig adroitly stepped aside. Perhaps, he suggested, it would be best if the president talked directly to his counsel about it. Reluctantly, the president agreed. He would see Buzzard at his first opportunity that afternoon. Haig walked his very disturbed boss out of the Oval Office. The president went to his EOB office for lunch and a quick nap. By 3 o'clock, Haig was checking on why the president was taking so long to see Buzzard. Ziegler, Rose Woods, and Steve Bull had been in and out of the president's EOB office all afternoon. Aside from Nixon, Haldeman, and the Secret Service, Woods and Bull were the only ones who had handled tapes. A few minutes before 4 p.m., the president walked back to the White House and upstairs to the residence. Half an hour later, he finally returned to the Oval Office where he rang Haig's aide, Major George Julwan, and said he was ready to meet with Buzzard and Haig. They found the president sitting with Ziegler. His ire had subsided, at least visibly. Haig knew very well that the president rarely allowed his anger to show. Predictably, Nixon did not confront Buzzard. Buzzard, in his mild way, reported what he had found the previous evening.
The president appeared concerned, but calm, as Buzzard described the sounds of the two tones.
"What did he think might have happened?" the president asked.
Buzzard said he had no answers.
What had been on the tape?
Buzzard didn't know that, either. Nixon said he could not recall what had occurred in the conversation. He had tried, but... Buzzard probed discreetly. Did the president have any explanation for what might have happened?
Well, he had spoken to Rosemary earlier in the afternoon, Nixon said, and she was very upset and confused.
Could there be some explanation other than an erasure, Nixon asked. Some technical fault with the equipment. Something which would account for the discrepancy between the length of the gap, as Rose recalled it, and the fact that it was now more than 18 minutes long. Could it have been caused by a foot pedal, by some combination of two controls activated at once, anything like that?
Buzzard was not sure, but he would check.
He discerned that the president was extremely concerned about the gap, but there was something invasive in Nixon's approach, something disturbing about his reaction. To Buzzard, he seemed to be suggesting alternative explanations for the lawyer's benefit, speculating on various excuses as if to say, well, couldn't we go with one of those versions? Buzzard prided himself on being able to tell when the president was lying. Usually it wasn't difficult. Nixon was perhaps the most transparent liar he had ever met. Almost invariably, when the president lied, he would repeat himself, sometimes as often as three times, as if he were trying to convince himself. But this time Buzzard couldn't tell. One moment he thought Nixon was responsible. At another, he suspected Woods. Maybe both of them had done it. One thing seemed fairly certain. It was no accident. On balance, Buzzard was more inclined to think it was Woods. If the president had erased it, he would have told someone. A client willing to suggest manufacturing evidence would be as recklessly candid about destroying it. Buzzard tried again. Perhaps Woods had mentioned something else. Or perhaps she knew more than she had told. No, the president said. Buzzard knew as much about it as he did. There would be serious trouble ahead, Buzzard warned him. Nixon exploded. What the hell do you expect me to do about it? He shouted at Buzzard. Buzzard recoiled. Calming down, Nixon turned to the possibility of recovering the conversation through some electronic means. Buzzard doubted that it could be done, but he agreed to pursue it. We should try to get hold of any notes that Bob may have made during the meeting, Buzzard suggested. They might shed some light. The president agreed. Then Haig sent Buzzard off to get the notes from Haldeman's files, which were secured in a file room in the EOB and guarded by the Secret Service. Within minutes, Buzzard was back in Haig's office. He did not have the combination to Haldeman's file cabinet. Haig remembered that when he had taken over from Haldeman in May, the departing chief of staff had told him he had ordered the combination changed. Fine, Haig had said, but be sure to leave the combination with the president. While Buzzard waited, Haig went to Woods. Had Haldeman given the president the combination? She checked her files. He had not. Haig was angry. Apparently, Haldeman's arrogance knew no bounds. He still thought of the White House as his private preserve. Haig called him at his home in California and explained the problem. Bob, I want that combination held at the White House, Haig said, and nowhere else. Haldeman responded that the quickest way to get the material would be to have his former administrative assistant Larry Higbee retrieve it. There were more than 40 drawers of notes and papers stored in the file room. He would call Higbee with the combination and direct him to locate the file. Passively, Haig accepted Haldeman's arrangements. Higbee was in the White House gym when Haldeman called from California at 5:45 p.m. He was trying to get a quick shave before going out for the evening with his wife. Higbee had worked for Haldeman for 5 years, carrying out his orders in such efficient style that administrative assistants in the executive branch were called Higbees by the White House staff. Higbee had an aide who was known as Higbee's Higbee. Now banished to the office of another former Haldeman aide, Fred Malik, deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget, Higbee loyally ran Haldeman's Washington errands. Haldeman was typically precise and direct Describing the problem briefly, he gave Higby the combination to his file cabinet and specific instructions. Go to Higg's office. Tell him you will get the notes. Go to the file room. Open the safe. Pull out the second drawer. Remove the brown cardboard pouch for April to June 1972 and the pouch for April 1973. In one of the two, you will find a yellow pad of notes for the meeting in question. Remove it from the pouch and call me back. Read me the notes, and do not under any circumstances give the document to anybody until you have called me and gotten my approval. Do not under any circumstances deviate from this procedure. If there is any deviation from my instructions, call me before proceeding. Higby understood. He went to Higg's office and said he would retrieve the files. Stopping by Buzzard's office to get a more precise description of the required material, Higby went to the file room on the fifth floor of the EOB. Buzzard followed him inside and waited. As directed, Higby removed the pouches. Going through their contents at a corner table, he told Buzzard he had found the right notes. Then he called Haldeman and read them over the phone while Buzzard waited for him across the room, out of earshot. "Hmm," Haldeman said. "That's no problem. Go ahead. Turn over the notes." "Buzzard wants the originals of the notes, Bob," Higby said. Haldeman was troubled by that, but agreed, provided that Higby place a photocopy in his file.
Chapter 6. After the meeting with Haig and Buzzard, the president walked through the Rose Garden portico to the residence. Inside, uniformed members of the Executive Protection Service straightened to attention. Nixon followed the ground floor passageway, past the portraits of former first ladies, to the arched entrance of the residence elevator. At the third floor, he stepped out, and as he walked up the ramp, he straightened from his stooped posture just before he reached the solarium. The 9 Republican senators who were waiting for him there had been the core of the president's support within his own party. They represented both the right and the moderate wings. Their constituents wanted to know why Nixon deserved such unquestioning loyalty. The senators were concerned about the party and their careers. They could not take any more of the revelations that had been filling the newspapers. They had to know if they could stand behind their president. They wanted his personal assurance. He gave it. He was innocent. He would prove it. The nation needed a strong president. He needed their support to be strong. They pledged it. The president's top political aides, Timmons, Bryce Harlow, and Tom Korologos, were there to see that nothing in the way of White House hospitality was lacking. The senators stayed for cocktails. Nixon left with Haig, who had stopped by, to mingle. As they walked, the president wondered aloud what Buzzard had found in Haldeman's files. Haig needed no further hint. He rushed dutifully to the file room. Buzzard had just gotten the originals from Higby. Haig grabbed the notes and turned to run back. Buzzard stopped him in mid-stride and directed Haig's attention to page 2 of Haldeman's notes. Haig read, "What is our counterattack? PR offensive to top this, hit the opposition with their activities. Put out libertarians have created public clamor? Do they justify this less than stealing Pentagon Papers, Anderson file, etc.? We should be on the attack for diversion." Haig was really upset now. There might be some question as to exactly what was said during the meeting. There might be some question as to who or what had obliterated the stretch of tape, but there was no question about one thing. The Gap wiped out a discussion of Watergate. Haig went to tell the president. Buzzard and Powers returned to the task of listening to the subpoenaed conversations, wondering whether more tapes had gaps. The next tape discussion of June 30, 1972, encouraged them. The material was intact, and most of it was privileged, unrelated to Watergate. They reached September 15, 1972, a discussion about Watergate involving Haldeman, Dean, and the president.
Dean had testified that the president had told him in this conversation, "Bob tells me what a good job you've been doing, John." Would the tape support Nixon's contention that he didn't know much about the cover-up when the original indictments were returned that day? The lawyers heard the president praise Dean's work.
"The way you've handled it has been very skillful, because you putting your fingers in the dikes every time that leaks have sprung here and sprung there."
But it was impossible to know exactly what Nixon was referring to. The conversation was troublesomely ambiguous. Buzzard and Powers were more disturbed by another part. The president was discussing the Washington Post and its lawyer, Edward Bennett Williams, with Dean.
"I wouldn't want to be in Edward Bennett Williams' position after this election," the president said. "We're going to fix this son of a bitch. Believe me, we are going to. We've got to, because he is a bad man."
Another of the president's remarks was equally damaging.
"The main thing is, the Post is going to have damnable, damnable problems out of this one. They have a television station, and they are going to have to get it renewed," the president said.
Dean mentioned how common the practice of filing challenges to license renewals had become.
"It's going to be goddamn active here," the president shot back.
The president's remarks worried Buzzard and Powers, but they decided that this portion of the conversation did not technically relate to Watergate. They would claim it as privileged and see if Sirica would uphold them. A third segment was more disturbing. Dean complained that the IRS was not cooperating with him in his efforts to uncover damaging information about one of the contributors to the campaign of Democratic presidential candidate George McGovern. The president was outraged.
"Well, goddamn, they ought to give it to you," he told Dean.
Nixon went on to plan how, after the election, he would make sure that the IRS became more cooperative. He would fire IRS Commissioner Johnny Walters for his failure to cooperate. Then he threatened to fire his Secretary of the Treasury, the cabinet officer responsible for the IRS.
"I don't want George Shultz to ever raise the question, because it would put me in the position of having to throw him out of office," the president had said. "He didn't get to be Secretary of the Treasury because he has nice blue eyes. It was a goddamn favor to him to get the job."
This was exactly the kind of presidential abuse of power which the impeachment clause of the Constitution was intended to remedy, Buzzard observed. The president was planning to use a federal agency for blatantly political purposes. But, strictly speaking, it too had nothing to do with Watergate. They would claim it as privileged, on the off chance that Sirica would see it their way. Buzzard expectantly threaded the March 21, 1973 tape onto the recorder. Nixon rested almost the whole of his case on this date, claiming that Dean had first informed him then of the details of the cover-up. For all its importance, the president had never listened to this tape. He had relied instead on Haldeman's reading, which matched his own recollection, that when he was told that day that the Watergate burglars were demanding $1 million as the price of their continued silence, Nixon rejected the blackmail decisively. It would be wrong. It would not work. The truth would come out anyway. John Dean was claiming differently. Nixon and Dean also disagreed as to whether the president had rejected the notion of granting the burglars executive clemency. Buzzard listened as Dean led the president through a relatively inoffensive discussion of Patrick Gray's confirmation hearings as chief of the FBI, and of how to keep the Senate Judiciary Committee from getting FBI files. The conversation led Nixon to a favorite subject, telephone tapping by Democrats. When, he asked, was Bill Sullivan of the FBI going to bring over the list of offenses committed by previous administrations?
"As soon as you get that, I'll be available to talk to you this afternoon," he told Dean.
Buzzard could hear the enthusiasm in the president's voice as he contemplated what Sullivan might have. Dean solemnly changed the subject. "The reason I thought we had a talk this morning is because in our conversations I have the impression that you don't know everything I know."
"That's right," the president said, his voice returning to normal.
Bozart relaxed. Dean and the president were going to corroborate what the president had been insisting on all along, that Dean had been off on his own. Dean alerted Nixon to the cancer, and then summed up how the cover-up had progressed through the summer of 1972 and the following winter. The problem was growing daily, geometrically, compounding itself. "That'll be clear as I explain some of the details," Dean said. "It is basically because, one, we're being blackmailed, and two, people are going to start perjuring themselves very quickly that have not had to perjure themselves to protect other people and the like." Bozart could not have been more pleased. It was as the president had said. Dean was explaining Watergate to the president for the first time. He played it back for Powers and then let the tape run. He could hear Dean clearly. He strained to hear the president's voice.
"How much money do you need?" Nixon asked.
"I would say these people are going to cost $1 million over the next 2 years."
"We could get that," Nixon said. "I mean, you could get the money. You could get $1 million. And you could get it in cash. I know where it could be gotten. I mean, it's not easy, but it could be done."
Bozart waited to hear the president say it would be wrong.
"But, the question is who the hell would handle it?" Nixon droned on instead. "Any ideas on that?"
The president and his young aide discussed who could be relied on to raise the money. The payments to the burglars might be made under the cover of a Cuban defense committee. It could be concealed from a grand jury. Bozart's brief optimism faded as he listened to Nixon and Dean conspire. Four times, the president discussed ways to accommodate the blackmail demands, never once implying that it would be wrong. Hunt was demanding $120,000 immediately.
"Well, your major guy to keep under control is Hunt," the president suggested. "Don't you... Just looking at the immediate problem, don't you have to handle Hunt's financial situation damn soon?"
Nixon answered his own question. It was necessary to keep the cap on the bottle that much in order to have any options. Powers noticed a sour expression on Buzzard's face. Dean told Nixon that the situation was so dangerous that aides would soon begin toppling like dominoes until finally they collapsed backward on the president. Dean was worried about being charged with obstruction of justice. He had been the conduit for paying the defendants. The president seemed to be getting the point.
"Oh, you mean like the blackmail?"
"The blackmail, right."
"Well," said the president, "I wonder if that part of it can't be... I wonder if that doesn't... Let me put it frankly. I wonder if that doesn't have to be continued."
Bozart shook his head and turned one earphone toward Powers.
"Let me put it this way," the president went on. "Let us suppose that you get the $1 million, and you get the proper way to handle it, and you could hold that side. It would seem to me that would be worthwhile."
Clearing his throat, Dean started to respond, but the president interrupted.
"Now, we have one problem. You have the problem of Hunt and, his clemency."
Bozart and Powers exchanged glances. It was not, after all, Dean who had raised the subject of clemency.
"That's right," Dean agreed.
Nixon had defined the problem.
"And you're going to have the clemency problem for the others," Dean said. "They all would expect to be out, and that may put you in a position that's just untenable at some point. I'm not sure that you will ever be able to deliver on the clemency. It may just be too hot." It was not the president who had suggested that clemency was out of the question, but Dean. By now, Buzzard was expecting still worse. Nixon delivered.
"You can't do it till after the 74 elections, that's for sure," said the president. "But even then, your point is that even then you couldn't do it."
He sounded disappointed.
"That's right," said Dean. "It may further involve you in a way you shouldn't be involved in this."
The president agreed.
"No, it's wrong, that's for sure."
At last, that
was what the president considered his decisive rejection of meeting the burglars' blackmail demands. It was about the clemency, not the blackmail. Even on that count, the president seemed to have gone along for practical, political reasons, and not until Dean had told him it probably wouldn't work. Buzzard listened to Nixon as he kept looking for a solution.
Dean estimated that Ehrlichman was probably vulnerable to indictment by the grand jury for soliciting the money that had been going out for months to the burglars.
But what I am coming to you today with is, I don't have a plan of how to solve it right now, but I think it's at the juncture that we should begin to think in terms of how to cut the losses, how to minimize the further growth of this thing, rather than further compound it by, you know, ultimately paying these guys forever. I think we've got to look, the president interrupted impatiently, but at the moment, don't you agree that you'd better get the Hunt thing? I mean, that's worth it at the moment. The president wanted Hunt paid off. He didn't want to be told that it wouldn't work. Buzzard heard Haldeman enter. Mercifully, the tape was approaching its end as Nixon led the search for ways to take care of the jackasses who were in jail. Six more times, the president returned to the subject of the blackmail, and then he restated his conclusion. For your immediate thing, you've got no choice with Hunt, but the $120,000 or whatever it is, right?
That's right, Dean agreed.
Would you agree that that's a buy-time thing, and that you'd better damn well get that done but fast? The president asked.
I think he ought to be given some signal, anyway, Dean said.
Well, for Christ's sakes, Nixon continued, get it in a way that, who's gonna talk to him? Coulson? He's the one who's supposed to know him.
Well, Coulson doesn't have any money, though, Dean noted. That's the thing. That's been one of the real problems. They were broke.
Someone remembered a secret $350,000 stash in the White House. The press had already learned about it. We are so goddamn square that we'd get caught on everything, Haldeman laughed.
It was a moment of singular truth amidst the squalor, Buzzard reflected. He marveled at their resourcefulness. In the course of the discussion, the president had considered almost every conceivable alternative, granting Hunt parole instead of clemency, using priests to help hide payments to the burglars, washing money through Las Vegas or New York bookmakers, convening a new grand jury before which the president's men would plead the Fifth Amendment or experience memory failure,
co-opting the assistant attorney general by having him appointed as a special Watergate prosecutor, everything but telling the truth.
Finally, they agreed to send John Mitchell out on an emergency fundraising mission. Haldeman, Dean, and the president were discussing the logistics. Then Buzzard heard the worst part of all. It was what he had dreaded. The president was addressing Dean.
You had the right plan, let me say. I have no doubts about the right plan before the election, and you handled it just right. You contained it. Now, after the election, we've got to have another plan.
Buzzard sat for a few minutes after the machine had stopped, considering what to do. He and Powers finished the analysis and indexing, and then Buzzard went to see Leonard Garment. Maybe Garment would have an idea. On the evening of November 17th, the president faced an audience of several hundred newspaper editors in a question-and-answer session scheduled as part of his campaign to regain credibility. The session began badly. The president, agitated and combative, confused his syntax several times. Reporters, he observed, answered tough questions. He referred to himself as he. When asked whether he still considered Haldeman and Ehrlichman two of the finest public servants he had known, he responded,
I hold that both men and others who have been charged are guilty until we have evidence that they are not guilty.
He was asked about his low tax payments, reported as $792 in 1970 and $878 in 1971. Bobbing on his feet and gripping the podium with both hands, he gave a rambling account of his finances, not of the period in question, but of more than a decade earlier. In 1960, after 14 years as a congressman, senator, and vice president, his net worth was $47,000, and a 1958 Oldsmobile that needed an overhaul, he said. Watching the performance on television, Buzzard and Garment pondered the president's strange demeanor. As he completed his answer, they felt Nixon was addressing them.
In all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I could say that in my years of public life that I welcomed this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
Well, I am not a crook, said Richard Nixon.
Buzzard and Garment knew they were already treading perilously close to the cover-up line. The 18-and-a-half-minute gap was not something about which they could wait and see if the prosecutors asked the right questions. This was not about a proposal to manufacture evidence. This was destruction of evidence. The lawyers were certain there was no innocent explanation, and they wanted the gap disclosed at once to the special prosecutor. If Jaworski were to learn about it secondhand, after the subpoenaed tape was turned over to Sirica, he might draw the inference that the president's lawyers had conspired to hide the destruction from investigators. The lawyers did not ask Nixon for permission to inform the special prosecutor. They simply told the president of their intention. They met with Jaworski on the morning of Wednesday, November 21st, at his office. Buzzard proposed that a joint investigation be undertaken by the special prosecutor and the White House to determine the cause of the gap. Not unexpectedly, Jaworski insisted that Sirica be informed of the gap at once. That afternoon, the day before Thanksgiving, Buzzard, Garment, and Jaworski met in chambers with Sirica for a secret conference.
Your Honor, Buzzard began.
He tried to soften the blow. While listening to one of the seven remaining tapes, he had encountered a new problem. The intelligence is not available for approximately 18 minutes. There is an obliteration of the intelligence for approximately 18 minutes. You can't hear the voices. Buzzard paused. It doesn't appear, from what we know at this point, that it could have been accidental.
Does not appear.
Sirica was puzzled.
At its worst, it looks like a very serious thing, Your Honor. If there is an explanation, quite frankly, I don't know what it is at the moment.
The missing portion was part of the conversation on June 20th, 1972, 3 days after the arrests inside the Watergate,
between the president and Mr. Haldeman.
It would indicate Mr. Haldeman was there talking to the president?
Sirica asked.
Yes.
Then there is a lapse.
Yes. The circumstance is even a little worse than that, Your Honor. I don't know how it could get much worse.
Just wait, interjected Garment.
We found Mr. Haldeman's notes of this meeting, said Buzzard. They consist of two legal pads of paper. The notes reflect that the discussion was about Watergate.
Later that afternoon, Sirica made the matter public and ordered an immediate inquiry to be conducted in open court. For the next 2 weeks, news of the gap filled the nation's front pages. Buzzard, Haig, Woods, Bull, Secret Service personnel, and other White House aides were called to the witness stand to explain. Woods was a star witness. She steadfastly maintained that she had accidentally erased about 5 minutes of the conversation, no more, while talking on the telephone. The photograph released by the White House to support her testimony was cruel. It pictured the president's secretary contorted at her desk, one arm flung back to a phone, a foot on the transcribing pedal. The statements were inconsistent. Witnesses could not agree on dates or whether recording machines were examined for malfunction or when tapes had been checked out. Woods had kept certain tapes locked in her desk. Others had been taken to Key Biscayne. Others had been given to Haldeman to take home. Sirica referred the matter to the panel of technical experts he had appointed to determine why the two tapes were missing. In the White House, the president was angry about how the whole episode had been handled. He spent hours talking to Woods and Rebozo about
how all of Watergate, this problem and the ones before, seemed somehow to derive from the incompetence of his lawyers. He was growing increasingly furious. On November 29th, he instructed Ziegler to announce that the legal team had made some mistakes and, accordingly, was being reorganized. It was a clear statement of no confidence. Haig expressed his private distress to the lawyers. The president was cutting them off at the knees.
"If we're going to do this, I'll quit," Haig told Buzzard.
Buzzard and Garment went to see Nixon. Now subdued, Nixon asserted that Ziegler had issued the statement without consulting him. He looked away from Buzzard as he spoke. He would order Ziegler to issue a clarifying statement. The exchange bolstered Buzzard's belief that Nixon was the most transparent liar he had ever met. Ziegler approached Buzzard later, very upset. Mrs. Buzzard was with her husband. Ziegler insisted that he had acted on the president's specific orders and asked Mrs. Buzzard if she would ever speak to him again. "Yes," she said. "Sure, of course." She was used to government. Afterward, meeting with Haig, Buzzard was succinct. He would adopt, he said, the dilatory approach in defending the president. If there was a reasonable way to explain the president's conduct, he would try. But he could no longer pretend, even to himself, that his client was a helpless victim of Watergate. The tapes, what was left of them, made that clear. At best, Buzzard and the other lawyers could try to establish the president's technical innocence. "We are officers of the court," he warned Haig. "If, in a file or tape search, we come across a smoking pistol, we've got to disclose it." Still, he would proceed slowly, Buzzard assured Haig. He would not search for the weapon. Nor would Haig. On December 6th, from the witness stand in Sirica's courtroom, the general speculated that some sinister force had been responsible for the tape gap.
"Has anyone ever suggested who that sinister force might be?" the judge asked.
"No, Your Honor," Haig replied.
At the White House, Jan Barbieri, a secretary in the speech-writing shop, pasted a picture of Bela Lugosi on a lampshade. Beneath the picture, she typed, "Sinister force." Garment reflected on the situation. Missing tapes, gaps, sinister forces, suggestions to manufacture evidence, lawyers on the witness stand, a client and old friend who would not hear his advice. But he was not really surprised. He had seen Richard Nixon lock himself into unreality and depression before. Garment went to see Haig.
"I want out," he said. Technical innocence was not enough. He could not function as a lawyer under these circumstances. It was a charade.
Haig was sympathetic. "Given the peril of the situation, I can't accept the fact that all the information is derivative," Garment said. "Everything came to the lawyers indirectly, almost never from the client they were supposed to be defending." Haig was impressed by Garment's refined language, his precise mind, his sense of humor. But Garment was a panicker, in his view, not a man to hang in for the tough battle. In war, one had to risk his own ass. Haig was willing. Garment wasn't. Garment elaborated on his position. He did not wish to do anything that would suggest disloyalty or defeatism. He would stay on at the White House, but he would drop out of sight. He could deal with cultural affairs, American Indians. There would be no noise. He would not resign. More in sadness than in anger, Garment recounted how he had hoped there would be some tapes or some evidence to prove the president's innocence. They didn't seem to exist. Garment wasn't blaming anyone. The real meaning of Watergate, he told Haig, was to be found in the passive acceptance of hiring two men, Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, and then standing by, letting it all happen. And after that, still more passive acceptance about how to handle Hunt and Liddy's exposure in an election year. The tapes that Buzzard had described to him
were so unclear, so ambiguous, he observed. Like every conversation in the Oval Office. Haig was in perfect accord. Garment began to reminisce about conversations in the Oval Office. Someone would say, "Let's bomb Tel Aviv." Now, that's not policy, but the tape would sound bad. While you're kicking around policy decisions, things come up. So the president told Dean, "Good job, John."
The president said it, but he always says good job.
Haig agreed. He'll say, "Good job, Len," on this or that. He says it when it has been a bad job or no job at all. Often, it has been no job, but it becomes, "Good job, Len." The president is guilty of misdemeanors. It is inherent in the office. Garment thought back to the weekend when the president had dismissed Haldeman and Ehrlichman, calling them two of the finest public servants it has been my privilege to know. That dissonant phrase should have rung several million alarm bells across the country, he realized. If Haldeman and Ehrlichman were such fine public servants, why had the president gotten rid of them? The day after their departure, Nixon arrived at a cabinet meeting trembling with anger. Passing the offices of his former aides, he had found FBI agents stationed outside to secure their papers and files. It was an outrage, an insult to the integrity of two great and good men, Nixon said. Who had ordered the FBI agents posted, he demanded. Who was it? He wanted them out of the government immediately, fired. He would see that somebody paid the price. In fact, Garment was responsible. He had raised the matter with Richardson and Ruckelshaus, and they had agreed that agents should be posted immediately. All three kept quiet on the matter during the cabinet meeting. The president calmed down only when he seemed to perceive that his own cabinet appeared concerned about his behavior. In the following weeks and months, Nixon repeatedly urged Haig to set up a mechanism to raise funds, either in secret or through public channels, for Haldeman and Ehrlichman's legal defense. Garment had advised Haig that it was out of the question, but Nixon pressed. If the Berrigans could have a defense fund, why not Haldeman and Ehrlichman? Eventually, however, Nixon seemed reconciled to the idea that no one on the White House staff would undertake the mission. The decision to fire Haldeman and Ehrlichman must have consumed the president with guilt, Garment thought. He felt tremendous compassion for Nixon. An act of both conscience and cowardice, Garment thought, of his own decision to abandon the president's defense. Chapter 7. Hugh Morrow was puzzled by the call from Robert Alplanop. Aside from Bibi Rebozo, Alplanop was the president's closest personal friend. Morrow was aware of the suspicion, the distrust, and jealousy with which the president regarded Morrow's boss, Nelson A. Rockefeller. Morrow, who was press secretary to the New York governor, had heard Henry Kissinger and Rockefeller talk about Nixon's concern that the Secretary of State maintained too close an association with his old patron. Now Nixon's friend was calling Morrow to insist that he come to Key Biscayne immediately. Alplanop was sending his private jet to pick up Morrow in Albany. Morrow was escorted into the five-house presidential compound. The warm Florida breezes were a pleasant relief from the bitter December chill of Albany and the Pocantico Hills. The men who were gathered in the converted office were all familiar to Morrow. Rebozo, quiet and polite, of Cuban descent, a self-made millionaire, the president's closest friend for nearly 20 years. Alplanop, outspoken and brash, fabulously wealthy from his invention of the aerosol valve. Haig, Kissinger's former chief deputy, with whom Morrow had spoken frequently before the general had become White House chief of staff. Haig came right to the point. "Hugh, we want you to be the president's new communications director with cabinet status. The president wants you to take it. Bob wants you to take it. I want you to take it." Morrow told the three men that he was very flattered, but he would consider the offer only if two conditions were met. First, Ziegler would have to leave the White House.
It was not a question of whether Ziegler was good or bad, said Morrow. The fact was, he had become a symbol of public mistrust. Second, the president would have to start answering hard questions about Watergate and, if necessary, allow himself to be questioned by the Senate Watergate Committee. Nixon had never really answered John Dean's charges, Morrow said. The White House had to stop this Chinese water torture in which every new fact, every new admission, had to be wrung out of the president. Haig didn't like that. He doubted that he could persuade the president to dump Ziegler. Not that he wouldn't like to see it happen, he said, but he was sure that the boss would never bring himself to banish Ron. Haig proposed instead that Morrow be given absolute jurisdiction over all aspects of press affairs while Ziegler continued as assistant to the president. Rebozo and Alplanop were more interested in getting Morrow on board than in haggling over Ziegler's future. If Ziegler had to go as a condition of Morrow's acceptance, then perhaps it could be arranged for him to move to the United States Information Agency or some other remote corner of the government bureaucracy, they suggested. They were less sure than Haig that the president would be intransigent on the point. They knew that Nixon recognized Ziegler's shortcomings in dealing with people, and they were convinced that Ziegler often presented the president and Watergate in the worst possible light, needlessly antagonizing both the press and the public. A new approach to media relations was essential. Everyone agreed on that. It was imperative that it begin at once. Knowing how heavily the president had lately come to lean on Ziegler, Haig was pessimistic. Ziegler might move out of the press area, but would have to stay on with the president. Morrow saw that Haig did not want to press the point with Nixon, and he recognized that the general's analysis was probably correct. Politely declining, he returned to New York. Ned Sullivan, whose wife and Mrs. Nixon were cousins, called Morrow several days later. "Pat and Julie asked me to call, and they want you to take the job," Sullivan explained. Morrow held to his original position. Sullivan pushed harder, urging Morrow to reconsider once more for the sake of the president's family. Morrow was firm. "No," he said, "he could not accept if Ziegler remained at the White House." In a White House where evangelist Billy Graham served as spiritual advisor to the president, the arrival of a rabbi from Providence, Rhode Island, might have seemed incongruous. But Rabbi Baruch Korf and the faithful who accompanied him into the Oval Office on December 19th were not there about religion. Rabbi Korf had begun a citizens' campaign to support the president 6 months earlier. The president had written Korf several letters thanking him. A 5-minute meeting had been arranged. The president gave members of the delegation the standard mementos, pins with the presidential seal for the women, tie clasps and cufflinks for the men. "How did you get started?" the president asked Korf. "I was offended by the Irvin committee hearings," said the clergyman. "It was theater. Someone would implicate others, and then he would be asked what legislation he would recommend to prevent things like this. It just didn't sit well. Senator Irvin pontificated. He's a good actor. Clergymen have to be good actors, too. He quoted from the Bible. I was incensed. I couldn't find some of the quotations." "They weren't in the Bible." The president dismissed the complaint with a wave of his hand. "He's a nice man," he said. "He was just doing his job." Korf told the president that he had been wrong not to destroy the tapes. Nixon seemed startled. "The day Mr. Butterfield appeared before the Irvin Committee," Korf said, "you should have. I found it morally and ethically offensive that the people didn't know they were taped. You had an obligation to make a big bonfire on the South Lawn." "Where were you 8 months ago?" the president laughed. The 5 minutes were long up. Nixon wanted more details about the movement, as Korf called it, and its founder. "I'm just a small town rabbi," Korf said. "I did not find the movement. The movement found me." Korf's organization was carefully named the National Citizens Committee for Fairness to the Presidency. The issue was a strong presidency, not Richard Nixon, Korf explained. The president agreed with that. Korf said he hadn't voted for Nixon in 1960 or 1968, but he had in 1972. "Why?"
the president asked. Korf's reasons were the issues Nixon thought were important and was sure had re-elected him: law and order in the streets, a strong national defense, détente with Russia and China. The president smiled. Korf spoke passionately about how the group had gotten started, and how he had used his own vacation money to finance part of a $5,000 ad in the New York Times. The ad netted more than twice that in contributions. A similar ad in the Washington Post brought in three times the cost. The meeting lasted 40 minutes, and the president asked Korf to come back and visit again. The next evening, Nixon appeared at the staff Christmas party in the East Room. He seemed happy, and his appearance was a boost to everyone's morale. The spiked punch flowed freely. 6 days before Christmas, the president said to a large group gathered around him, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even the president. There was awkward laughter. It might be kind of hard to do, the president continued, but if you can't get enough here, come on upstairs. We've got plenty. If you drink too much, you might go in the wrong door and surprise some girl, but if you say you were at the White House, she'll say come on in. It didn't make any sense, but they laughed anyway. In the clear light of the next day, the president could see he faced grave difficulties on two fronts. His legal strategy had collapsed with the Saturday Night Massacre, the tapes that never existed, and the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. In the process, his public relations strategy had been made a mockery. Begun in early November and dubbed Operation Candor by the press, it had been based largely on Nixon's repeated assurances that there would be no more bombshells. But each time that the president announced that Watergate was behind him once and for all, another disaster had hit. Nixon cursed the Times, the unfairness of it all. The impeachment investigation was beginning. There was speculation about resignation. His staff was restless. Bryce Harlow had written a letter saying he wanted to leave. Garment had signed off the legal team. Ray Price had been prevailed upon to stay beyond his planned departure date in December, but he was not happy. The Republicans on the Hill were unhappy. Senator Barry Goldwater, a key to his support in the Senate, had given an interview to the Christian Science Monitor. His words stung. He, Nixon, chose to dibble and dabble and argue on very nebulous grounds like executive privilege and confidentiality when all the American people wanted to know was the truth. I hate to think of the adage, "Would you buy a used car from Dick Nixon?" But that's what people are asking around the country. General Haig doesn't know anything about political matters. I just can't believe that Nixon would listen to Ziegler. That, in my opinion, would be something disastrous. Again, there is nothing personal, but Ziegler doesn't understand politics. Worried and miserably unhappy, the president asked a small group to join him and his family for dinner on December 21st. Bryce Harlow and his wife, Barry Goldwater and Mary Brooks, the director of the Mint, Pat Buchanan and his wife, Ray Price and Rosemary Woods. None of the lawyers was asked, nor was Haig or Ziegler. The president, waiting for all the guests to arrive, downed a quick scotch in the yellow oval room, the formal living room in the family quarters. At the dinner table, he sniffed the cork from the wine and pronounced the choice inadequate. A bottle more to his satisfaction arrived. During dinner he was jovial at first, bantering with those seated close to him. But by the end of the main course, he had begun to ramble. He told his guests he wanted to spend the holidays in Key Biscayne, but that the energy crisis made a plane trip for a vacation inadvisable. A train trip was conceivable, but it would be unsafe and expensive as well. Turning to Price, the president referred to the State of the Union address that Price was working on. What ideas should they focus on? Then, before Price or anyone else could respond, he shifted rapidly to another subject. Kissinger's name came up. Mrs. Nixon complained bitterly that Kissinger was getting credit for all the good things her husband had done. The group left the table for after-dinner drinks and more conversation. Nixon seemed to be trying to reach out to each person, as if to convince himself that this was his team, Harlow thought. But the president was having trouble getting his words out. Bryce, explain what I'm saying to Barry, he said several times, after having given up himself. Harlow would start to explain, but then the president would interrupt him. Watergate was mentioned. The president, observing that he was beset from all sides, offered a rapid-fire catalog of the ways he might recoup his fortunes. But Republican support on the Hill was limp, he said. Impeachment was a partisan issue, but his side didn't seem willing to do what was necessary to defend him. He was a victim of circumstance, of uncontrollable forces. It was the timing, the particular point in history. The Democrats and the press were now working together to get him. He had inherited a much-abused office, flagrantly misused by Kennedy and Johnson, but the liberals and the press hated him, and so the rules were being changed, and he was going to be made to pay. The president was, in some way, only trying to thank his family and the others for their support, Price was thinking. But he certainly wasn't handling it well. Buchanan thought, the old man is tired and can't hold his liquor well, especially when he's exhausted. The next day, Goldwater called Harlow. Is the president off his rocker? No, he was drunk. Goldwater was half convinced. The president had felt trusting enough about those at the table to let down his